So let me ask you guys a question. This one is maybe a little easier. What is your favorite celebration that you've had? Maybe it's a wedding, birthday. What is it? Come on, everybody's got a celebration that they love or maybe they can remember. Yeah.
It's one of my favorites, but today we are celebrating 62 years of wedded bliss.
Wow.
And I have a candle that I got, and with my wedding gown that was all numbered, and it's about this big now. Oh, wow. And I will take it to Rudy's tonight, and we will burn the stove.
And have a lobster, right? Right, you're going to celebrate, aren't you? That's awesome. 62 years. All right, that's awesome. You know, most people just want to live 62 years. You've been married in bliss for 62 years. That's really something else. That's great. Well, how about some other people here? Come on, everybody's got a celebration. I was hoping Les was going to be here. I was going to ask him if he remembered any particular birthday. Thanksgiving? That's one of your favorites.
It really is. That's the one day where you stop and pay attention. And
eat a lot. Eat a lot, right? Yeah, you do. It's the one time it's not a sin just to not be able to push away from the table. That's right. It's not commercialized. Okay. There's one. Vera?
We celebrated yesterday. My daughter graduated with her BA in Christian Studies.
Wow.
That's
always the hope, isn't it, parents? I hope they get a job from all this money I spent, right? Well, anything else? Come on.
Opening day.
Oh, Steve and I are in alignment on that. Opening day fishing, opening day hunting are big days every year. Steve and I are looking forward towards October. I guarantee it. It is. We start talking about it. Well, we're talking about it today, weren't we? Lauren, you had one? Yeah. Right. Right. And heaven knows you go to enough where that isn't the case. I've even done a few funerals for Lauren, and you know, there's seven people there, and three of them aren't talking to each other. So that can happen. Well, I'm surprised nobody said Christmas. Huh? No, come on, what's wrong? You know, hey, Christmas in July is coming up. Hallmark, right? You've seen one? You've seen them all, you know?
That's the problem. We're starting to talk about it now.
Huh. Oh, man. We got a bunch of Ebenezers in this room. I was hoping. I love Christmas. I love everything Christmas. I do watch Christmas in July. I love Vermont and all that, and I'm afraid to go there because it'll ruin it for me, you know? I love that the movie, the Hallmark things have a happy ending. You can predict it. You know, they're about to kiss, finally get it together, and somebody interrupts them. Right? Happens every time. I tell Lisa, I say, you know what's going to happen? She, don't tell me. I go, you know what's going to happen. Don't tell me. And I go, well, you know they're going to get interrupted. You told me. And then they get interrupted, and then I'm in trouble for the rest of the movie, right? Today is about celebration and why that's important. And every one of us has had birthday parties. We have anniversaries. Thank you very much. 62 of them for some people. We celebrate births, graduations. We like to celebrate. Why do we like that? What's with a celebration? You ever think about that? Let's dissect this a little bit. Because we're actually going to break this down a little bit today. It's a big part of your lives. You guys may not realize it. You've spent a lot of money on celebrations over your life. You know that? Yeah, all the people who had daughters. Yeah, we know. Pretty expensive, huh? What is it about a celebration? Why do we do it? It's a happy time, right? Yeah.
It's a time to share with your family and friends what your life is.
It's a gathering, isn't it? And you remember last week, they gathered to defeat an enemy, and so now they're gathering to celebrate. to commemorate. But, you know, we have to break that down a little further. And I think we just do it because when we say celebrate, yeah, it's a good time. We get together, we party down, you know, there could be music and dancing. And actually, Jesus' first miracle was where? At a wedding celebration. And really, they got down. I mean, you know how much wine they drank there? I mean, it tells you right then, like 60 to 90 gallons. And the celebration went on for quite a while, right? So it's a big thing, and I think we pass over it. But the book ends on celebration and an epitaph. So without further ado, let's break into this last chapter, or the last part of a chapter in the last chapter. Sorry, everybody thought we were done last week. Sorry, you're not done. And the main component of celebration is to remember, right? We do these things so that we'll remember it. And if I asked you how many birthdays you can remember, there might be a handful. You know, your 21st, maybe your 40th, 50th, something like that. Eventually you get to the point where you can't remember your birthdays. So, yeah, or you don't want to, yeah. And so I pulled this out of Deuteronomy. And you'll see in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, it's a big deal to remember. And I just pulled this out. The whole chapter is really something else. I remember Lauren taught on this chapter a number of years ago, and it had a profound effect on my family. We kind of got involved in that whole movement at the time. So, and this is what it says: "And these words I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk to them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise." And then it goes on to tell why you should do this and why we should do that. So I want to, in the context of remembering, I thought this is nothing new that we're going to study here. It's all over the Old Testament, specifically there. And this is actually repeated again by Joshua. So let's read this. "And Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were on all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month of Adar, and also the 15th day of the same, year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness, and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days of sending gifts of food to one another, and gifts to the poor." So the Jews accepted what they started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman the Agite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of the Jews, who had plotted against the Jews to destroy them, and had cast lots, to crush and destroy them. But when it came before the king, he gave orders in writing that this evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore, because of all that was written in this letter, and what they had found faced in this matter, and what had happened to them, the Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offsprings, and all who joined them. I'm so sorry. I got to assign somebody this. That without fail they would keep those 2 days according to what was written, and at the appointed time of every year, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, in every clan, province, and city, and that these days of Purim should never fail to fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai the Jew gave full written authority confirming the second letter about Purim. I don't know where we are. Oh, here we back up a little bit. Okay. I'm going to give this to somebody here in a second. Where are we? In Purim. Letters were sent to all the Jews to 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus, in words of peace and truth, and these days of Purim should be observed at their appointed seasons, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther obligated them, and as they obligated themselves and their offspring with regard to their fasts and their lamenting. The command of Queen Esther confirmed these practices of Purim, and it was recorded in writing. There we go. King Ahasuerus imposed tax on the land and on the coastlands of the sea, and all the acts of his power and might, and full account of the high honor of Mordecai, to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Ahasuerus, and he was great among the Jews and popular with the multitudes of his brothers, for he sought the welfare of his people and spoke peace to all his people. Okay, and you'll see the first question I have there is, Pur is the Persian word for Lot, while its plural form is Purim. Was the fate of the Jews decided by a roll of the dice? Is that what happened when Haman said, and they kept rolling the dice? Is that, was the fate decided by that, the roll of a dice? What do you think? Kind of a trick question, isn't it? Sort of, right? Yeah, Haman sure thought so, and so did the Jews. Everybody thought, yep, yeah, oh gosh, it came down to this day and a roll of a dice. Yeah, that was right. Haman says, pick a number. You and I will pick a number between 100, 1 and 10, and I'll tell you who wins, right? So, yeah. So who's got Proverbs 16:33? Vera does. Thank you, Vera. Did you all hear that? The law is cast into the lap, but every decision is of the Lord. So Haman is sitting there rolling the dice, and everybody thinks it's just the roll of the dice, but the Bible tells us, no, even the roll of the dice is up to the Lord. What is that saying? What's that saying? He knows. You know, I got into my car this morning and my watch buzzed. I went, oh, I wonder who's calling me now. And it said, 13 minutes to Trinity River Drive. My watch knew where I was going this morning. And it knew better than I did how long it was going to get there. And I went, I'll bet that's not right. And you know what? It was 13 minutes. Usually it's 17, right? Because of the no traffic. Nobody's going to church apparently at that time in the morning. So it knows, but the Lord knows all those things. So that dice is in the Lord's hands. How about the next one that we have here? It says, after studying the book of Esther, how can we view the events surrounding our lives as Christians? This is as Christians. This is all of you. And we've got another one to read, right?
Ephesians.
Yeah. Paul, in all his letters, says this in one fashion or another, doesn't he? You can go to any of his letters and his opening salvo, and he's going to say this in some fashion. Working all things according to the counsel of his will. That's what Paul says. That's what the Old Testament says so many times, and that's what this book kind of happens to say, is that this is the providence of God, right? And we see that repeated in the New Testament, and Paul is doing that. So what is the end game for believers? So what does this mean for us as believers? What's our end game? We've gone through this whole book now. We have established that God is not mentioned in this book, and yet we see God's providence and deliverance. So what is that? You know, we know the rest of the story. They didn't know back then. They knew there was a Messiah coming, but they didn't know that it was going to happen on December 25th. So, okay, tongue in cheek. We don't know exactly the date he was born. But anyhow, he was born, and all that takes place. They don't have that knowledge, but we do. We have the New Testament, right? So what does this book and other books in the Old Testament say to us as deliverance for us, knowing the rest of the story? What do you think? It's a promise. Yeah, there's promises for us, and we know the promises that those things have happened, right? What if you go back to the Old Testament? You got to kind of have a macro view here. That's what I'm asking you to do. Okay, so when you talk about King David, And remember last week I talked about a polemic argument, right? There's basically two things the Old Testament is going to do in a polemic argument. It's going to argue for the law and the prophets, okay? And I gave you an example. What is the life of David? You can tell the story and there's applications to be made, but what is the great polemic argument of King David? What would you say? When you look at his life, what's the promise? When you read his Psalms and everything else, what is, if you could boil it down, and there's many things, but there's one in particular. Okay, that's true. Messiah is going to come from him. Why? That's right. That's exactly right. But why him?
He's got a good name.
He's got a great name. Huh?
That's
true. All these things are true. But what's the greatest thing about King David? I gave you a hint right there. He's a king. Right? And there was going to be a king after King David, like King David, but superior to King David. And the end game for us, and we're talking about King Ahasuerus, right? The end game for us is one day, God's going to bring everything, and I mean everything, on earth and in heaven under the subjugation and the jurisdiction of a king, King David, or not King David, King Jesus. That's where this all ends up. That's where this all points. So all these are little pictures and things all pointing to that thing. And we have to keep that in mind. For us, there's a, you know, as we close this book, as believers, we have to say nothing in our life is haphazard, right? And not just because of this story, but because of other stories as well. And particularly when you get to the New Testament. And that'll close up a little bit. And I wonder how much differently the church would look, or the world would look, if believers all kind of, you know, doesn't matter your denomination, we went, you know, instead of arguing and fighting about this or taking this point of view or that point of view, we just settled in the fact, well, God's in charge. And there's a reason for this. I don't understand it. Let's still do the things in his manifesto, which is the law, the Ten Commandments. Let's just follow those Ten Commandments. And, you know, you and I see things maybe a little different politically. It doesn't matter, but this is our king. These are the things we can agree on, and we just go with that. How much different do you think it would look? I think it'd be very different. We would at least appear like we're on the same page sometimes. Okay, put it in writing. The situation has been reversed. The Jews were heading like a freight train towards a particular day that forecasts their destruction or ruin, and yet it has turned out for deliverance. And what is their reaction? They got delivered. I mean, just boom. Happened pretty quick. They were like going to die. And then they pulled together. It wasn't certain. We saw last week that they won. And then what was their reaction?
Celebration.
Well, it was 2 days. It took a while to get there, and we did a timeline last week. If you remember, I had that timeline up there. But it took 2 days, essentially, especially in the capital of Susa, for this to transpire. But, you know, it kind of, that's the way things used to happen back then. They didn't have strategic, you know, bombers and counterattacks with tanks and stuff like that necessarily. They just, you saw them, they saw you, they ran at it and had a fight, you know. So that's kind of how it happened, but it was resolved in 2 days. Good question, though. Good. And then immediately after, have you ever had anything happen to you where you go, what? Whew, that was close. And you were just so relieved there was such a change? Oh, you have?
I was robbed by gunpoint when I was living in Hollywood.
No kidding.
And the guy was so hyped up, and I think I was his first victim. Shaking like this the whole time.
That's a good thing and a bad thing.
And he dropped his gun, but I wasn't quick enough to get it.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, so he got it back. And it's only by the grace of God I'm here today.
Isn't that something? Yeah, he's really nervous. He might miss, but he might go off on accident, too, right? You're and when that was all done, you were...
I had no money. I just couldn't even afford.
Your first reaction is, I was broke. No, but I mean, you were really relieved you made it out there with your skin. I mean, yeah.
Yes. Isn't that a blessing? Yeah, because, you know, we're working night shift. And so if the other people buy, if somebody flies to go get them, right?
Right.
They take turn if my night to fly. So I'm just like, here, take my hamburgers.
Yeah, here's my hamburgers. And then you get back to work and go, guys, I didn't eat them, honest. I got robbed. They're like, sure. That's really something. How about if you've been driving and, you know, maybe you're slippery and you're just driving along, all of a sudden you get into a spin out and you avoid, and you go, wow, right? Whew, heavy sigh. It's kind of like that. There's a little bit of spontaneity about this. I think they just break into a celebration and they're celebrating. So that's the beginning of it, right? So they're celebrating. In verses 20 and 21, he uses his position to do what? So it kind of goes like this. We won. Whew, I'm so relieved. Hey, I got an idea. Let's throw a party. Okay. They throw the party, and then what does Mordecai do? He says, good idea. Let's put it in writing. Right? So he makes it official, which is interesting. I mean, if you all have a party, you had 62 years, nobody's coming along saying, we're going to make this official, and everybody's going to celebrate 62 years with you, right? Only the people at Rudy's are going to do that tonight. And one smoldering candle. But I'll never forget it. Right, he makes it official, and you say, why? Why is he making this official? I mean, there's obviously lots of parties in the Old Testament, right? There's lots of celebrations, but there are certain celebrations. If you think about them, all the feasts are a celebration of deliverance, and here's another one. So why? What's the obvious? It's important to him, right? Remembrance. Remember this. He's saying, this is really important. We don't forget it. And so we've had a celebration. That helps you remember, right? You have a big wedding feast, and then years later, you can look back and remember that wedding, right? That whole thing. Finally, you take pictures. You do everything you can to memorialize it. Well, in this case, they don't have cameras, right? They make it official to help us not forget. Simple, right? What happens... That's the next question. Yeah, that's exactly it. It is. What happens when we don't teach to the next generations? What happens when we don't have commemorations? What happens? Forget. How many of you know anything about your great-grandfather? A little bit? You know a little bit? Okay, how about your great-great-grandfather? That's what, two generations away? How about you? You know your great-great-grandfather? Anything about him? About him? How far can you go back?
To his farm.
So that's three? That's it? Three. Although I will say that you're in front of Abraham Lincoln now. You are, aren't you? If you do the dating on that. On your third great-grandfather, you're way before Abraham Lincoln. So that's pretty cool, at least. At least you got that. Doesn't take long to forget, does it? He absolutely did. That's an excellent point. I hadn't even thought about that. But he knows the power. I mean, sort of you bring this up. It sort of their Achilles in this whole thing was, hey, Queen Esther says, you know what? Haman's made a decree, and it's going to cost all my family their lives and even me. And the king is what? Oops, can't do anything about that, but what I can do is give you a competing decree to fight that off. But he couldn't change that, right? And so Mordecai is taking advantage of that, saying, hey, we're going to make another one of these. And then he goes into detail, doesn't he? It's not only you, but you're going to, and we're going to talk about this, you're going to obligate yourself to it. Is this anything new? Can you think of any other Old Testament scene where they do this? How about the Jordan River and Joshua? And they had to stack some stones. Do you remember that? They stacked some stones. Can you imagine? It's just a little muddy river. I'm from Lovelock. Anybody know the Humboldt River? It's from me to you at some points of the year. That's kind of like the Jordan. And sometimes it's from me to the wall, and you wouldn't even step foot into it. But that's pretty rare. But they stack stones in this thing, and then with low water every year, they go back and visit it. Why? To remember it, right? To remember. And when you don't do that, you guys all know Fiddler on the Roof, the play. By the way, it's Coming Music Circus. I got tickets. Very cool. In the beginning of that, he talks about what? Tradition. That's how he starts it, tradition, and then he sings it. And behind him is what? The fiddler, and he's on the roof, and he's playing, and he's bouncing back and forth. And at the end he says, if you don't have tradition, you become as unstable as a fiddler on a roof. How preposterous is that, right? And there's really a lot of truth to that. These things that happen are super important. If we don't remember, then what happens? Yeah. And we repeat the problems, right? So it's very important. And it says in verse 23, so the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. Why do you think this is pointed out? Why do you think it points out that the Jews accepted it? He writes it down, it's official, and the Jews went, fine with us. Why is this important? Well, the answer is in a question that I ask, not the next question, but another question. How do you feel about the word obligate? When you feel obligated, or do you want to make others feel obligated? How do you feel about that? Do you like feeling obligated? No? Okay. How about, do you guys like to make others obligated?
No.
I'm going to remember that, Dave. It's not nice. It depends on the obligation, doesn't it? Well, let me ask you this. Do you want to be obligated to something that you don't accept? It's not going to work. Just try to... Steve bought a Ford pickup not too long ago, and there's a contract there, right? And he's going to obligate himself. If he doesn't accept it, how's he going to obligate himself to it? I know Steve, he's going to say, no, no deal. He has to do that all the time. He's a contractor. He has to say, yeah, no. Let me look at the obligations we're under. Yeah, I'll take this. We got to change that, right? So you have to accept it. And then back to the question of obligation. So you don't like obligation, right? Okay. You've been obligated for 62 years, haven't you?
Yeah.
Would you have it any other way? No. Do you want your husband obligated to you? You betcha you do. Has that changed in 62 years? Has it changed in 62 years? Do you still want them obligated to you?
Oh, absolutely.
Yes, absolutely. No, obligation is a great thing. It really is. You want your children obligated to you. And you are obligated to them as a matter of law up until they're 18. Obligation has become a bad word. And I'm going to tell you, it's a source of a lot of our problems in our society, in my opinion. Come on, kids. Time to go down to the river, where your great-great-great-great-great-grandfather stacked a bunch of stones. What are we going to do? We're going to get there, and we're going to stare at those stones, and we're going to think about why he stacked them. I don't want to go. I don't think so. You know what? You're going. You're going. You're going to learn this. You're going to know. And one day, you're going to thank me for this, right? Because I'm obligated to teach you this. I'm obligated that you know why it is that you're sitting here sniveling while I feed you and provide for you. Yeah, you know the story. So it's a good thing to be obligated. We shouldn't just obligate ourselves to any old thing, right? Is this a bigger deal? I guess I ought to keep up with this, huh? Somebody ought to just take this from me, okay? Okay. Is this a bigger deal than simply accepting an invitation to a party and celebrating a victory? Is it a bigger deal? Yeah. Because I'm in the ether. You know what that is when I say that? Okay, so there's not too many people who have knocked animals out, huh? Huh? No idea. So when you... put a nesticide, an animal for operation, In the old days, you just take ether, put it in a bag, boom, they go over. But right before they go over, they're in a pretty good mood. They feel pretty good. So they're in the ether. Okay, so while you're in the ether, we just won, you're celebrating, it's easy to do this, but how about 30 years from now, right? You've been married for 62 years, and you're like, I could take a leave of the guy now if we don't have to go out to Rudy's, right? No, but it does wear off, and so you have to obligate yourself. It is a little bit more. Okay, in verse 28 it says, "And these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation." Why the emphasis? Why is Mordecai pushing this to be official? He's really making a thing out of this, isn't he? Just like me. He's making a big deal out of this. If it's going to be official, you're going to do it every year, and your generations are going to do it every year, and everybody is obligated to do this. Why? Why does he want this to happen? And I will say this. Why is that? Why would I even point that out? Because in March, you know what? They celebrated Purim. Yeah, they still do it. You got to give them credit. Yeah. Oh boy.
Invited to everything. And often they start with a formal service.
Right.
But even if they're still involved in their home, they have a formal service along with the joy and the fun stuff.
Right.
They celebrate it every time and talked about, and the children are the ones who have to answer the questions.
Right. If you think about it, just from a historical, that's a great point, by the way. Thank you. If you think about this, Alexander the Great hasn't been here yet, right? He's coming. The Roman Empire isn't here. Ottoman Empire. These empires haven't taken over yet. And so with these empires coming to bear, the culture has radical changes, doesn't it? And you look at us today, and where's my phone, right? You go to Denny's or wherever, and there's three girls and three boys, six kids, and they're all sitting across the table doing this. Right? So the culture has changed to that extent. And in every generation, culture changes. The 60s changed. We had the Beatles, you know, and then the 70s, we had disco. And so it's influenced by all these different factors, isn't it? So he's pushing this because he wants to give other generations an opportunity to see something different, to celebrate this, to tell that story. And if you don't obligate them to do that, and if you don't do that, it gets lost. Think about this. How many, I saw a thing on, you know, what did we just celebrate?
D-Day.
Huh? D-Day, right? A guy goes out and he's at a campus and he starts asking people in their third and fourth year on a campus of, I won't name the campus, but don't send your kids to Harvard. That's all I'm going to say. And he starts asking them questions about Normandy and World War II. They didn't know anything. You know what date it was? I mean, it was frightening. So without it being official, guess what? That doesn't happen. They don't remember. And I'm sitting here going, oh my goodness, the reason you're standing here not speaking Sprechen Sie the Deutsch is because these people went and sacrificed to the extent they did, and they don't have any knowledge of it. The culture has completely mowed that over, and it was quite alarming to me. But that's just me, and I digress, I'm sorry. But that's why he's pushing it. Mordecai recorded it, and the people, where are we at here? Here we go. And the people accepted it. Esther confirmed it, and we see here that principle, the obligation here, is established by the testimony of two witnesses, and sent it out in words of peace and truth. Is this different than what you would expect? Is this something that you would, after this all happened, he's being very peaceful and truthful. Is this what you would expect him to do after this?
Yeah.
What do you think would happen if this was a Republican or a Democrat that has this victory? Huh? What do you think they'd be doing? You think there'd be any spiking the football, doing a little end zone dance? Huh? Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. And in those days, there would be no conversation about peace. It would be all about celebrating themselves, okay? And what we did to them, no regard whatsoever. I think this is an interesting response that he has. And we all understand it because we come from a Judeo-Christian ethic. And so we see this as something proper to do. But it's not even a consideration. I'm telling you, if Haman would have won, do you think it would have been the same message of words of peace and truth? No. I don't even know what it would have been. Okay, so I'm going to need some help here. Who will take Galatians 1:4? Somebody have a Bible? Let's get a hand up here. Okay, he's going to get Galatians 1:4. And then somebody, Lauren, will you take Colossians 1:3-14? And I'm not going to do chapter 27 in Matthew, but we'll just talk about it briefly. It says, what should we be thinking when we read the Old Testament stories of deliverance? When we read these, and there's many of them, right? You can all fill in your Bible students. You can fill that in for you. But what should we be thinking as Christians and New Testament people when we think of deliverance and we go through these stories? Go ahead. Why don't you read that? Nice and loud. Yep.
Who gave himself for our sins to rescue us from the present evil age, according to the will of our God and Father.
I call this my Esther New Testament verse. Who gave himself, when we think about deliverance, in a New Testament spirit, who gave himself for our sins to deliver us from the present evil, the evil age, according to the will of God the Father. In other words, this is God's providence to have him delivered unto us. So all these people get delivered, and yet Jesus doesn't get delivered. He gets delivered up for us. And it's the only instance where that happens. All the rest of the people are delivered up or get delivered. In this particular one, the one who deserves to get delivered gets delivered up. Who's got the other one, Lauren? Yeah, that's the only way we can look at deliverance when we look at Old Testament stories. Starting back in Egypt, starting back when Abraham, you know, gets, or Jacob, or any of the patriarchs get, you know, under the weight of, you know, crushing odds and they get delivered. It's all pointing to a deliverance in the New Testament. Okay? What can we learn from this brief summation? This is chapter 10. Let's get to chapter 10, and then we're going to finish this up and talk a little bit about it. What can we learn from this brief summation, and how does it fit with the rest of the narrative? And you'll remember, it's just an epilogue about King Ahasuerus taxing the people, doing what governments do best. They tax in all 227 provinces. And then it talks about Mordecai. And it ends with Mordecai, which is interesting because the book of Ruth starts with Naomi. Tells a story about Ruth and Boaz and Kinsman and Redeemer, and you get to the end, and it's about Naomi again, right? And the baby and going down to King David, right? There's a little genealogy there. This one starts out with the king, and it ends with the king, but, you know, she isn't even mentioned in the last chapter, right? But the king is doing what kings do. They tax. The queen is not mentioned, and Mordecai is honored. It's an epitaph. Lauren has a cemetery. My brother is a sexton, and I love looking at headstones. Anybody like that? Okay, come on. Tell me, what do you like about it?
You read things that they should never have put on the headstone.
Well, that's for sure. Yeah, there's things you should not put on a headstone are written there writ large, right? Anything else? I mean, what else?
I always look at how old they
how old they were, right? Oh, or how young? You're going, wow, had a good life, or, oh, that's a sad one, right? I wonder how they died, right? Well, it's Reg Grant. I don't know if any of you know him. He's a professor at Dallas Seminary. He loves doing that, and he found this one. It went like this. It said, he's going along, and he sees this headstone, and it says, "Pause, stranger, as you pass me by, for as you are now, so once was I. As I am now, so you shall be. So come along and follow me." Right? And then scratched underneath it, it says, "To follow you, I am not content until I know which way you went." Right? So anyway, and that has absolutely nothing to do with Esther, but it is an epitaph. But he's honored, isn't he? This chapter 10 just basically honors him. And it says something very important. It says a record was kept. Right? And you think about all the life that's gone on and all the records that have been kept. You know, the Bible is the best record-keeping document there is, and there's not even anything closely related to Second, because it's just phenomenal. The more you study it, the more you realize how important and how connected it is, right? So he kept a record, and then ultimately they were relieved. And then finally, there's a great sadness involved with this story. When you get to the New Testament, before you get to the New Testament, you have this. And Lauren taught on this. I went back and looked at the notes on this. This is pretty interesting when we did Isaiah. And it says, "He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not." And Isaiah is a book written to Jews. And it's written to the Jews. And this is a story about the Jews. And he said, you know what? The Jews are not going to esteem the one sent to them. There's a great sadness in this at the end of the day, isn't there? But their minds were hardened, for to this day, when they read the old covenant, that same veil remains unlifted, because only through Christ is it taken away. Yes, to this day, whenever Moses is read, that veil lies over their hearts. Isn't that sad? Or this is in Romans, it says, "I am speaking the truth in Christ. I am not lying. My conscience bears me witness in the Holy Spirit that I have great sorrow and uneasing anguish in my heart. For I could wish that I myself were accursed and cut off from Christ for the sake of my brothers, my kinsmen according to the flesh. They are Israelites, and to them belong adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the worship, and the promises. To them belong the patriarchs, and from their race according to the flesh is the Christ, who God over all, blessed forever. Amen." And then finally, "He came unto his own, and they received him not." So, there's a sadness there, and it just reminds me to pray for the Jews. You know, they have given us so much in the Old Testament, and there's so many pictures of Messiah, and this is one of those books that does that. And then I just want to say every Sunday is blank for those who claim Jesus as Lord. And if you had that in front of you, I would say Easter Sunday, right? Every Sunday is Easter Sunday for those who claim Jesus as Lord. We have that to celebrate. And our celebration, we did communion last week, right? And you remember the words when you get into Matthew 27 and the Last Supper. It's a new and everlasting covenant. And and they get together for a dinner party. And I want to ask you guys this. When you take communion, it has a solemn aspect to it. But what do you think? Should we be celebrating, or should we be so solemn and not be talking? What do you guys think? You think we should be celebrating? Yeah. Now, if you're liturgical, my background is liturgical, Lutheran, Catholic background, we refer to the Eucharist as something that you what? You celebrate. Celebrate, right? It's a celebration. And I think we've, unfortunately, we walk up there and we don't even say hi. We don't look at each other. And we should be, and for crying out loud, it's bread and wine. It's Italian food, okay? This is a good time to celebrate. And by the way, I hope when you're on vacation with your family and that you take advantage of this and you celebrate the Lord's Supper. He says, do this in memory of me. Remember what I've done. Celebrate this. It's a joyous occasion. Our lives should be marked by joy and celebrating. And our favorite celebration should be that celebration of the Last Supper, right? And it was pretty sad on Friday, but we were in pretty good mood on Sunday. Because that's what we get to be part of, isn't it? And how easy is it to forget that, right? Super easy when I get involved in my week. So I'm going to ask this question. Does Jesus rule over your storm-tossed heart? Does he have access to every aspect of your life? Have you ever said lately, Lord, I need a great deliverance. I need deliverance from myself, from my selfish habits, from my desires, from a heart that wanders. I probably ought to just frame this as a prayer for myself. Esther is ultimately in the Bible to record that God is in the business of significant deliverance. That's what he does. That's why the book's there. And we're supposed to understand that this unspoken, unseen God has stepped down into the time by making peace with us through shed blood. It starts in the beginning, the promise for it to happen. It happens. We're on the other side of that. And, you know, I wonder what your takeaways are. I hope that this book, as you refer back to it, gives you confidence to face your trials, because they're going to come. We're getting older. I'm going to go get my hip done here pretty soon. And I hope it helps you to boldly step out when you're interacting with other people, because you can say, you know, I don't know that it matters so much, you know, that I get it right. I think what matters is who I'm aligned with. I'm on the side of Mordecai and Esther, not Haman, right? And that God's going to move the pieces necessary, sometimes when you're sleeping, you know, on the chessboard to move other people that he has plans for. And he's got a plan for such a time as this for every one of us. And I need help remembering that, and this book does that. So that concludes the book, but I want to ask you, we're going to ask some questions, and then I'm going to have Lauren come up and conclude us in prayer, since he concocted the idea, or some of the idea, to do this book in the first place. So I didn't tell him he's going to do that, but you're going to do that, Lauren. So, what is there any surprises that you had in the book? Anything surprise you that maybe everybody knew the story going into this, right? Everybody had heard of Esther. Anything surprise you about the book this time around? Come on. You guys are going, I don't even remember the first chapter. It's been 10 weeks, right? Anything? Anybody have a favorite part? Did you say something, Per?
Oh, you were reading my mind.
Okay.
No, it was not so much a surprise, but it was good to just remember what she went through, her feelings, the whole complexity of her vision. So she was a very brave woman.
Oh, yeah. A lot of pressure, huh? Yeah. Anything else?
Yeah, for me, not only with Esther, but other parts of the Bible that I'm now reading for the first time in my case, is how much violence and war.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of crazy when you think about how easy it is to be deluded into thinking that violence and war in our present age is not a thing. You know, we're much too civilized to take other people's lives over a piece of ground or commerce or something. No, it hasn't changed a lot, has it? Pretty scary. I got to tell you what I was surprised about. I was surprised about the earthiness of this book, about the back and forth between her and the king. I mean, it was scandalous to some point, to some degree, right? I mean, the Bible isn't supposed to have people sleeping with people that aren't married. That obviously occurred. And that God used that. God used her beauty, right? It says that a number of places. You can't escape that. I think I read over that with scaled eyes thinking, you know, of course the Bible isn't going to talk about things that are real, right? No, it does. And this back and forth between her and the king always surprised me. She went to school and learned how to do the things that men are attracted to, and she used that fully. You can see her doing that in the way she talks to the king, the way she dresses, the way she interacts with him, is very much like I would see my wife do to me when we were courting. There's no difference. I was a lamb led to slaughter. And all the guys are going, yeah, me too. Yeah. No, but it's there. Were you kind of surprised about how this went right down into some things? You're like, ooh, boy, can we talk about this in Sunday school? Yeah, no, it has to do that. I thought that was kind of amazing. What else? Anything else about the book surprise anybody? Or?
Yeah, I guess the fact that Mordecai and her, well, the Jewishness was no big thing. People didn't seem to know that.
Yeah, they did him, because they always referred to him as Mordecai the Jew, right? Him they knew, but they had no idea about her. And that is amazing. I didn't catch that till this time around.
She communicates somehow out in the balcony, but maybe she sent her a servant.
Yeah, I think she... Yeah, that was kind of interesting how that happened. I had forgot about that. That, you know, she was sending somebody out to talk back and forth to him. And how I think probably the people knew things, but in the corridors of power, they were clueless, which is oftentimes the case, right? Again, that reveals life. I mean, you talk to a politician who makes decisions about your life, and he has no idea what it, you know, what it's like out there in the real world, right? Anything else?
I think just her bravery. I mean, the risk that she really took. Could have gone. Really
could have went bad. Yeah, I mean, she put herself out there, huh? Mm-hmm. And what about Mordecai? What do you think about him? What would you say was noteworthy about Mordecai as we conclude the book? I think what struck me most about him is he had an opportunity to do in the king. Right? He did. He could have just let that. He went, oh, those guys are going to kill the king. It sounds like a pretty good plan. Probably would go through. Well, you know what? I think I'll sit back and let this happen. And by the way, he's sort of, you know, he's a member of a prattle state as a sort of a, not a slave, but he was captured. And he's under that, and, you know, he could have let that happen and had every right to maybe not like the king, but what does he do? He does the right thing, doesn't he? He's a citizen, which I think is an interesting thing when you get to the end of this book. It's about taxation, and Mordecai now is part of that governmental system. And Paul tells us, hey, that government that's there, guess who put it there? In America, you're a democracy, you get the leaders you deserve, right? But God somehow says, well, I'll make sure you get the people you deserve. And that's what happens, right?
Yeah, I think also that Mordecai was so intelligent in writing and all yeah. those skills of communication.
Very good, yeah. But he's ethical, and I think, you know, that stands out to me how ethical he is. He's very ethical. And his concern was, even with his own adopted daughter or cousin, whatever, but he's the father figure here. He says, you know, you have to go do this. I know it's risky, but if you don't, you know, God's just going to raise somebody else that does. And we have an obligation, again, to what? Our people. That his concern was never for himself. He's like the polar opposite from Haman, isn't he? So that was interesting. What about the king? Anything, any words about the king? What do you think?
Haman?
No. King Ahasuerus, Xerxes. Aha, where us? Anything? I think he really benefited from the whole thing, don't you? He got a better queen. He got a better second man. And at the end, he's getting some of his money back. He's probably not going to have some people giving him bad advice, so he gets into more wars, and he doesn't. He actually did pretty good. If you read the secular accounts of this, he does pretty good. Now the kingdom falls into disarray years down the road, but it's quite a ways down the road. He was actually pretty successful, and most of his success was during that time when he had a good right-hand man.